Well, hey, thanks for stopping by. I'm Fraser, and this is Mum Says It's My Turn. So, a trailer just dropped for the new Star Wars show. Who's ready to be disappointed again? I know it's not just me. The show is called The Acolyte. It's set long before the events of the Star Wars movies in the High Republic era. So, it's all new characters and a whole new story, which is a good start. One criticism I've had of modern Lucasfilm is that they seem obsessed with just milking the old good content. The trailer, it doesn't look great. Like some of the other recent stuff, it looks a little low budget. The trailer's got Carrie Ann Moss in it, who is a bit of a legend, most famous for playing Trinity in the Matrix movies, one of our strong female leads from a few episodes back. But one good actor doesn't guarantee anything, and actually a quick glance at IMDb shows that she's only in one episode, so never mind. The action in it looks pretty lackluster. This has also been true of modern Lucasfilm. The lightsaber duels of the prequel trilogy, episode 1, 2, and 3, were unreal. And with every new installment of Star Wars content, it just feels like we'll never get back to those golden years. The small amount of dialogue we get in the trailer also comes off as pretty clunky and uninspired. The show's creator, Leslie Headland, seems to be a big fan of the Star Wars franchise, but as we've seen with other recent Star Wars projects, just being a big fan doesn't cut it. Hopefully, she has the goods to back it up. I had kind of told myself I wasn't going to bother with any new Star Wars releases, having been let down by Lucasfilm so many times recently. And when I say recently, I mean probably since the last good Star Wars movie, Rogue One, was released back in 2016. We could probably do an entire episode on the tragedy that is modern Star Wars, but that is not for this episode. The thing is, recent Star Wars now pales in comparison and just seems so mediocre compared to another big sci-fi release of recent times. You guessed it, Dune. Most people will probably know that Star Wars was heavily influenced by the Dune books. Some might say it even kind of ripped them off. I won't get into that. But yeah, I wanted to talk about Dune today, including the latest release, Part 2, which came out in cinemas at the beginning of March. I'm going to be diving pretty deep, so if you still haven't seen this movie yet and you want to watch it completely unspoiled, then maybe skip this episode and consider coming back to it. If you're on the fence about watching it, then maybe this episode will help convince you to give it a try. So if the Dune movies have somehow completely passed you by, they're science fiction movies directed by Denis Villeneuve, the first of which was released back in 2021, with Part 2, like I said, coming out about a month ago. They're based on the Dune series of books written by Frank Herbert, the first one coming out back in 1965. And there are like 100 books set in the Dune world. Well, there are 6 by the original author and then I think another 20 or so that were written by his son. I came to the films not having read any of the books or having seen any previous movies. I still haven't. Although at this point, I'd really like to read the books. But after I saw the first movie, I could just tell I was going to be super invested in any subsequent films. So I wanted to hold off reading the books so that I could experience the films with fresh eyes. This is at least my perfect excuse to avoid having to actually read something. So my understanding is that Dune Part 1 and 2 follow the events of the first book. Now, the world of Dune is vast, complex, and political, but the story itself isn't too hard to grasp. What is potentially hard to grasp is who everyone is and how the various elements of the story relate to each other. Now, as is typical of sci-fi, there are made-up languages, multiple factions, numerous planets, so I thought I'd try and unravel this web for you. The films follow a character named Paul. He is heir to a great house, House Atreides, of which his father, played by Oscar Isaacs, is Duke. Also part of the Atreides gang is Josh Brolin and Jason Momoa, who are high-ranking members of the Atreides army. Think of houses in Dune as something like medieval lordships, with houses having fiefdoms, or planet systems in this case, under their control. The ruling house is House Carino, headed up by the Emperor Shaddam IV, that's Christopher Walken, and his daughter is Florence Pugh. Now, there is a great deal of infighting and political tension between the great houses. House Atreides, for example, are bitter rivals with House Harkonnen. The Harkonnen are ruled by the evil Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, played by Stellan Skarsgård. He's the big guy always taking baths. His nephews, Rabban and Fade Rutha, are played by Batista and Austin Butler. In addition to the great houses, there are other powerful groups at play. Some of them barely get a mention in the movies, but one that does is the Bene Gesserit. These are the characters that are dressed up like Victorian ghosts. They are led by Charlotte Rampling's character. The Bene Gesserit is a deeply powerful religious sisterhood manipulating the Imperium from the shadows. Our main character, Paul's mother, played by Rebecca Ferguson, is a member of the Bene Gesserit. They have an ability to control other people using something called the Voice. They also act as divine matchmakers, intertwining royal bloodlines with the intention of creating the Kwisatz Haderach, a powerful human that can essentially see into the future. The final group of note in the story is a people called the Fremen. This is Zendaya and Javier Bardem's group. They are the oppressed natives of a desert planet called Arrakis, which is central to the story of Dune, as it's the only place where the spice melange is found. This unusual psychoactive substance is the most valuable in the Imperium. It extends life, is essential for space travel, gives the Bene Gesserit some of their powers. It's a big deal. Okay, that's a lot of backstory, and honestly, we've barely scratched the surface, but that should be enough for now. It's a deep, rich storyline full of intrigue and tons of moving parts that's very satisfying to see play out on the big screen. Visually, the movies are unbelievable. It's absolutely crammed with these terribly dramatic cinematic shots that rely heavily on practical visual effects and very little on CGI. Because of this, it's unlike anything you've seen before. Yet, it's all still very grounded and plausible. In case you hadn't guessed it already, I was a big fan of the Dune movies. I absolutely loved them. I was completely obsessed with part one when it came out, and I've watched it at least a dozen times since. So, at the start of the first movie, Paul and his family have been tasked by the Emperor to move to the desert planet of Arrakis to oversee production of spice. There are many weaving threads that center around Paul becoming something of a messiah figure to the locals on Arrakis, and potentially the aforementioned Kwisatz Haderach. Towards the end of the first movie, House Atreides is attacked by their rivals, the Harkonnens, with the help of the Emperor's army, forcing Paul and his mother to flee. There's also probably a few contenders for perfect scenes in that first movie as well. Specifically, you could consider Duncan Idaho's Last Stand, where he valiantly holds off the Emperor's soldiers, giving Paul a chance to escape, or the entire sequence around the Harkonnen invasion of Arrakis. But if I had to choose just one scene, I'd probably go with the Gom Jabbar scene. So this scene was apparently one of the first scenes that was shot. In it, Paul is tested by one of the senior members of the Bene Gesserit. He has to keep his hand in a box that inflicts excruciating pain, and if he doesn't, he'll be killed. It's a test to see if he can overcome his animal instincts of self-preservation. The scene basically opens in this oppressively dark library, and Charlotte Rampling's character sat in the middle of the room waiting. The whole scene is a perfect example of the mysterious, religious, iconic nature of the whole film. Denis Villeneuve describes it really well, actually, in that it's a futuristic sci-fi movie, but it has a very historic, ancient feel to it as well. It's also incredibly well acted. There's one of my favorite examples of the voice being used, where Charlotte Rampling's character uses the voice against Timothy Chalamet's character to make him walk across the room and kneel in front of her. The shots are all very meticulously created and edited together, and the score also perfectly narrates what we are watching but can't necessarily see, which is Paul's internal struggle at this moment. What do you think? Perfect scene material? Anyway, I was naturally very excited to see the follow-up when it was released, so we went to see it on opening night. At just under 3 hours long, it's in desperate need of an intermission, by the way, which obviously you don't get. And no, I will never let this go. Other than needing to pee for the last hour or so, I actually didn't want it to end. I was completely caught up in the movie. In part two, Paul, being presumed dead by the Imperium and the evil Harkonnen, begins living with the Fremen. He and his mother Jessica attempt to integrate into the Fremen. Jessica begins spinning stories about how Paul is the coming of the Fremen Messiah, the Lizan al-Gaib. And whilst Paul initially refutes this, he kind of also encourages this theory by doing a bunch of impressive stuff, like riding an enormous sandworm. This all leads to Paul raising an army of Fremen against the Emperor, killing Baron Harkonnen, and setting himself up as the new Emperor. It's pretty dramatic stuff. Like its predecessor, it's such a delicious movie, like there's so much to sink your teeth into. Let's talk about our director, Denis Villeneuve. He's becoming more and more of a household name. I've talked about him on this podcast before. I'm going to risk coming off like a massive fanboy, but he is a masterful storyteller. He has such a deep-seated understanding of character emotion, visual storytelling, pacing, mood, and ambience. His breakout movie was a film called Incendies, which was released back in 2010. It wasn't a huge movie commercially, but it definitely set him on a good track. After that, he did Prisoners with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal, which is a great movie. He followed that up with Enemy, Sicario, Arrival, and Blade Runner 2049. We recently rewatched all of Denis Villeneuve's back catalogue, which was great, but did leave us kind of depressed because none of his films are particularly happy. They all tend to be a bit more moody and atmospheric. For reference, Sicario is probably his most upbeat movie. From the perspective of like epic cinema, each movie was definitely a step up from the last. All his films were great, but not necessarily without fault. Blade Runner 2049 actually reported something like an $80 million loss at the box office. However, even though the movie wasn't incredibly viable commercially, it was still a visual masterpiece. It still had great acting and an incredible moody vibe to the whole thing. And thankfully, it was enough for the owners of the rights to Dune to let Villeneuve take a crack at adapting it. Rumor has it that Denis Villeneuve was actually lined up to direct the last Daniel Craig James Bond movie, No Time to Die, but turned it down in favor of working on Dune instead. And based on everything I've seen of him talking about these movies, it's clear that these are the films he's always wanted to make. I saw in an early interview that unlike any of the movies he'd made before, his intention with Dune Part 1 was to create a film for an audience of one, being himself. He has stated that he was an enormous fan of the books growing up, so presumably had a very clear vision of how it should look and play out on the big screen. And I think that this self-assuredness was apparent for his first Dune movie. It was dark and moody and dramatic. Greg Fraser returned as the cinematographer for part two. And like I say, visually, these movies are unreal. I read that Roger Deakins was supposed to be lined up to shoot the Dune movies after having worked with Villeneuve on Blade Runner 2049. Now, you all know I really love Roger Deakins, but I'm also a big fan of Greg Fraser. He's taking some big strides in his career. Some notable projects from the last few years include Lion, which he got the Oscar nod for, Rogue One, The Batman, and The Creator. He also won the Oscar for cinematography for Dune Part 1. And I think it's fair to say that he stepped up his game for Part 2. The way the movie is shot plays an enormous part in the storytelling in a way that I think surpasses the first film. I'm thinking specifically of some of the scenes shot on Gedi Prime, the Harkonnen homeworld, with these massive wide shots showing these incredible set pieces and the harsh black and white tone to it. I read that they shot these scenes using an infrared camera, which gives these scenes their iconic look, as well as giving the skin an unnatural tone. Also, the fight scene between Paul Atreides and Fade Rutha, which is Austin Butler's character, which has some stunning silhouetted shots with the dunes of Arrakis off in the background. Speaking of Arrakis, a ton of effort was gone to shoot the sand dunes in the best way possible, with multiple real-life deserts being used for their specific dune orientation and which direction the sun comes in from. All this immense effort leads to some stunning wide shots of the desert scenes. Plus, there are some mind-blowing sets used for Dune Part 2, and the cinematography does a lot to do these sets justice. I also read that for both movies, all of the scenes that were shot in the desert only use natural light. This is a complicated technical undertaking, but definitely enhances the realism and the believability of the shots. Hans Zimmer also returns to score the second film, and again, the score is one of the standout elements of this movie. The score for the first Dune movie was massive and unexpected, I would say. It has wailing banshee-style vocals, bagpipes, melodies played on instruments that didn't exist before recording the score for this film. It's fair to say, I think, that Hans Zimmer pushed his creativity to new heights for the first Dune film, and then again for the second one. He has such a knack for really emphasizing moments in a film using the score. Obviously, every composer does this for every film to some extent, but Hans Zimmer seems to do it in a way that is, like I say, unexpected and just a step above everyone else. One specific example that comes to mind is the scene in the first movie where House Atreides is under attack on Arrakis, and Josh Brolin's character is leading the resistance, and he turns to his men and he's like, "With me!" And then the bagpipes kick in with this epic rallying melody. I can't imagine that there are many composers that would have an idea like that, but it's so effective, and watching that scene gives me goosebumps every time. Part 2 has another beautiful soundtrack, though. Hans Zimmer seems to draw a lot of inspiration from the desert itself, so like the thudding of the thumpers that are used to draw the attention of the worms, the wind blowing through the dunes, the sound of sand rolling down. But it's also a super epic soundtrack that lends to the grand cinematic nature of the movie. If you're interested, I'd recommend checking out the track Lisan Al Gaib from the soundtrack if you want to get pumped. In the original Dune books, the planet of Arrakis was based a lot on Middle Eastern culture, with the Fremen people supposedly being based on the Bedouin people. And I think this Middle Eastern influence really comes through in the soundtrack. Now, let's talk about the cast quickly. The first movie had a pretty stacked cast to begin with. As I mentioned, Timmy Shamalimi plays Paul Atreides, the protagonist. Only his friends are allowed to call him that, by the way, so don't you all start calling him that. You all still have to call him Timothy Chalamet. It's got Oscar Isaacs, Rebecca Ferguson, Jason Momoa, Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård, Zendaya, Charlotte Rampling, Batista, and Javier Bardem, to name a few. Ridiculous lineup. The second movie sees the addition of Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Lea Seydoux, and Christopher Walken. I mean, for crying out loud. There was also the shock introduction, and cover your ears if you don't want to hear this, of Anya Taylor-Joy as a future version of Paul's unborn sister. I wasn't expecting that when I saw it. She was completely uncredited for this movie, presumably to keep it all under wraps. Anyway, let me just say that everyone is bringing it for this movie. Seriously. But there are a few standout performances that I think have to be recognized. Anyone who knows me knows how I feel about my boy, Timmy. And the last thing I saw him in was Wonka, so I was a little worried about my immersion, let's say. But he's top draw. His character is very complex and undergoes a lot of change in this second movie, but I think he delivers it extremely well. He's so compelling to watch. Rebecca Ferguson also annihilates in this film as Jessica, Paul's mother. Again, her character undergoes a lot of change throughout the course of this film, especially compared to the first film. Her performance is very powerful. The scenes where she uses the voice on the people, you know? But again, it's interesting that the audience's perception of her changes throughout the film. And I think that comes down a lot to a very convincing performance. Denis Villeneuve has described Rebecca Ferguson as a Stradivarius with an insane level of precision. And I think that, firstly, that's an amazing and totally unique compliment, but also very true, I would say. Austin Butler also deserves a mention here. He's an actor that's just going from strength to strength these days. His version of Fade Ruther is psychotic and brutal, but again, you kind of can't take your eyes off him. He plays the role of Stellan Skarsgård's character's nephew incredibly well, and has even made his voice uncannily similar to Skarsgård's for the role. It's kind of mad to hear it the first time. Josh Brolin is back with a vengeance in the second movie, reprising his role as Gurney, which is great because we're not sure whether he makes it at the end of the first. His character, though, is also very different from the first film. He plays a broken man, really addled by the need for revenge, which is apparent in Josh Brolin's performance without being egregiously overt. And finally, probably also need to shout out Javier Bardem, who has a much more prominent role in the second film compared to the first. Probably a more subtle performance than some of the others mentioned here, but so, so good. His performance represents the perception that the people of Arrakis have towards Paul. And I think he delivers that shifting perception in a very engaging way. Those are just a few of my favorite performances from the film, but like I say, everyone in it is good. We don't get to see much of Florence Pugh in this movie, Florence Pugh being an absolute machine of an actor. But as I understand it, should a third movie get created, her character will be much more prominent. So fingers and toes crossed for that third installment. Also, one of my admittedly few criticisms of this film is that we don't get enough of Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken is one of those actors that has such a ridiculous presence in a scene. And I was seriously here for it when I saw that he was going to be cast. But yeah, I was a little sad to see that he wasn't utilized more in this film. I also feel like they toned down some of his Christopher Walken-ness. Maybe that's a good thing for this movie. You've got him like, Paul, you've got to give me back the spice. I don't know. I don't do a very good Christopher Walken, but you get the idea. So there wasn't enough Christopher Walken, and that leads me on to some of my other minor gripes. Now, when I first watched it, I was completely caught up in it, like I say, and I didn't really have anything negative to say, with the exception, as I mentioned earlier, of me just not wanting it to end. In retrospect, I think that this desire for it not to end, whilst in part due to the fact that I was just enjoying myself so much, was also due to the fact that it felt like we were kind of rushing through things a bit. And I've had similar conversations with a few people since seeing it. I mentioned that the characters Paul and Jessica undergo a lot of change throughout this movie. There's also a relationship between Paul and Zendaya's character Chani that evolves quite a lot in the film. But it feels a little bit like these elements didn't have enough time to breathe in the film, making it a little hard to follow or at least understand the motivations. I've made sense of some of these things by watching interviews with Denis Villeneuve and some other videos. He explains that in this film, we're meant to see Paul go from a hero to more of an anti-hero, and it's meant to be a bit of a cautionary tale about people getting a messiah complex when everyone around them is telling them that they're a messiah. And Zendaya's character, Chani, is supposed to be the sort of grounding character that represents the audience being like, no, don't do that, Paul. The thing is, for whatever reason, and I don't think I'm alone here, as a viewer, I was more like, hell yeah, Timmy, let's start this holy war, let's go. And I found Zendaya's character to be kind of unreasonable, honestly. Maybe I'm just a bit of a warmonger, but I wonder if just a little more time had been spent making sure that these things were being perceived correctly, then it might have felt less jarring. Additionally, it has come out that there were major roles and several scenes that were cut completely from the final edit, which makes me wonder if it should have been split into two more films, or at least just been longer. Really, when you've hit 3 hours, you know, what's another 45 minutes? Unfortunately, recently, Denis Villeneuve has come out saying that he doesn't believe in releasing extended editions or deleted scenes, which is honestly a little heartbreaking. I can see why he might take that stand, although using The Lord of the Rings as an example, the theatrical cuts were perfect for the mass audiences, right? Whereas the extended cuts were for the super fans, people who would be willing to overlook some pacing issues in exchange for more backstory and more world building. Anyone out there agree? All that being said, don't get me wrong, I'm really obsessed with the Dune movies. I just mentioned Lord of the Rings, and I really think Denis Villeneuve's Dune movies are a bit like today's Lord of the Rings. Faithful recreations of a much-loved franchise. Previous attempts at bringing them to the big screen didn't quite capture the scale and spirit of the source material. But, you know, the Peter Jackson incarnation of The Lord of the Rings represents some of the best movies ever made. And I really feel that way about the Dune movies. We have a perfect storm of someone who is obsessed with filmmaking, deeply passionate about the stories from the books, surrounded by some of the best film professionals alive. It's worth noting that Dune Part 1 won 6 Oscars in the 2022 Academy Awards. It didn't win Best Picture, which I felt like it should have, but it did still win 6 compared to Fellowship of the Ring when it came out, which won 4, and Return of the King, which was the third Lord of the Rings movie, won 11, so it tracked upwards, and I could easily see Dune Part 2 doing very well in the next Oscars. Hopefully it gets the recognition that at least I feel it deserves as one of the best movies made in recent years. And I didn't want to get too corny here, but we really are lucky to be able to enjoy movies like this. Please, if you haven't already, go and see this film in the cinema. And if you have seen it, go and see it again so that the studios know to budget more movies like this. Dune 3 hasn't officially been confirmed yet, but Dune 2 did make more than enough money at the box office to all but guarantee we'll see at least one more installment. I, for one, cannot wait. Anyway, that's it from me today, guys. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Let me know what you thought of the latest Dune movie. And if you're enjoying the podcast, share it with a friend. Tell them to keep it secret and safe, but not that secret. In the next episode, I'll be joined by a guest to talk about some of my favorite foodie movies. So make sure you check that out. Cheerio!